Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of July 18th through 25th. This week we were joined by Professor Nicholas Cafardi. He is the Dean Emeritus and Professor of Law at Duquesne University School of Law, and he has an article in the current issue of America called Keep Holy Election Day, Suggestions for Faithful Voting.
Maybe you could begin by explaining why the words holiness and voting belong in the same sentence. It seems almost like these ideas are kind of almost contrary.
It does, doesn't it? But yet we've seen, certainly in recent elections, appeals to our faith in determining how we should vote. And when you make an appeal to a person's faith, the whole purpose of faith is to get you into heaven. And the way you do that, of course, is to live a holy life here on earth. So I think there's an obvious connection between being holy and voting.
Now, maybe we can start with the idea of holiness. That idea obviously comes from the Gospels. What are we called, what is the idea of holiness?
Well, when the Lord was asked what it took to be holy, his answer was in terms of love. I've always found that interesting, that the Lord describes holiness in terms of love, but, he gives the answer that you must love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole soul, your whole mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. So he describes holiness in terms of love. And then he goes on to say, and if you want to be holier still, give everything away and come follow me, which is a really selfless form of love that, of course, most of us find too difficult to practice.
So if we take the idea of holiness and bring it into the voting booth, what are the kind of characteristics of holiness in voting?
Well, again, I think to be holy, you have to keep in mind what the Lord said holiness requires. And then, as almost any other moral decision, you're really engaged in a kind of ongoing discussion in your conscience with the Lord as to what holiness in any given situation requires. Because, again, the whole purpose of being holy is you want to do what the Lord would do in that situation. Again, I think the imitation of Christ is another way to define what it means to be holy. So you're involved in that ongoing internal discussion in which you're really talking with your conscience, but hopefully a properly formed conscience and an informed conscience.
Yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, about the role of conscience in holiness. Obviously, you quoted from the gospel there what we're called on to do, but when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of everyday decisions, our conscience plays a role.
Sure it does. As our bishops have said, conscience is the voice of God inside of us, telling us what's true and calling us to do what's right. Certainly, I think that's a very, very valid perception of how conscience works. But again, untethered feeling, the way we feel about something is not our conscience. Our conscience has to be based on truth. And where do we get that truth? We certainly get it from the Gospels. We get it from the traditions of our church. We get it from the teachings of our church. We get it from the guidance of the Spirit in our own lives. All that's important. You really can't have a meaningful internal discussion with your conscience unless you've done all those things.
Now, what role does the church play in kind of informing holy, Catholics, and also kind of informing conscience?
Well, again, I think that since conscience is based on truth, and since we find truth in the teachings and the traditions of the Church, that's one of the best places to start. It would be difficult, I think, for a Catholic to say they had a well-informed conscience if that Catholic himself or herself had not tried to inform themselves on what the Church teaches in a certain area, what the historic traditions of the Church have been in a given area, and of course, what do the Gospels say about this? So, to a certain extent, that's a repetitive exercise because the Church's traditions and teachings all come from the Gospels.
But we do have documents like Faithful Citizenship by the U.S. Bishops, which try to kind of lay out perhaps a little more concretely what some of the issues are. So how
right.
have documents like that helped?
I think Faithful Citizenship is a great document. I think the bishops did a very good job in 2007 when they put Faithful Citizenship together. I understand that they may be thinking of making some tweaks in it in their meeting in November of this year. I don't think it needs much tweaking. I think it really is a very balanced document. I think they do a good job of laying out what the church's positions are on the important political issues of our day. And I think that the probably the best thing about faithful citizenship is, you know, it doesn't make political choices. It lays out what the teachings of the church are and then asks Catholics to apply those teachings in their own conscience, in their own moral lives, to their participation in the political process.
Now we're a good year removed from the presidential elections, at least, but there has been a lot of talk, at least I'm calling from New York, regarding, you know, questions of Catholic conscience and public legislation, in particular the same-sex marriage bill that was just passed here in New York. Maybe we could talk about that as a particular issue in terms of, you know, obviously, well, Catholics are falling on different sides of the line.
Sure,
here.
They are, and you had Catholics vote for that legislation and Catholics vote against that legislation. And I'm hoping that both sides do it with an informed conscience. I think when you look at same-sex marriage, there are a number of distinctions you could make. For example, when a state legislates on same-sex marriage, what they're really dealing with is a creation of the civil law. Civil marriage is not the sacrament of matrimony. And civil marriage is basically a social construct. It has changed over the years in the way the state has defined it. The state, you know, there was a time when the state said that if you were one spouse was white, one spouse was black, you could not get married. The state has changed the way it's defined civil marriage, and no matter how the state defines civil marriage, it's not really it has no effect on certainly the sacrament of matrimony. Now, if you make that distinction and you're a Catholic legislator, you might feel more free to vote on different types of civil marriage, as, for example, same-sex marriage, as long as you and your conscience are sure that the legislation is not going to affect the rights of the church. I could see a Catholic legislator making that decision in good conscience. On the other hand, a Catholic legislator could think that you know, the law of the state has to reflect natural law, and natural law says that marriage is between one man and one woman, and therefore has an obligation under his faith to vote against same-sex marriage. I think an informed conscience could come down on either side of that issue. The important thing is that your conscience is informed and you're acting in good faith.
Now, there's been much talk about the kind of acrimonious atmosphere in Washington and how politics seems to be becoming more and more polarizing. Is there a way in which the pursuit of holiness could improve kind of this rough and tumble environment?
Well, I think holiness requires that we do not demonize people with whom we disagree, you know, people on the other side of an issue. I think we have to presume their good faith. Just because they don't see moral issues which have a political aspect to them the same way we do, you know, doesn't mean that they're evil people. Doesn't mean that we have a right to as I say, demonize them with language like, you know, the party of death or other kinds of pejorative terms that really, first of all, aren't fair because they're not fair characterizations, but second of all, in a certain way, dehumanize the people who are on other sides of the issue than where, you know, Catholics might be. I think that would be a good place to start. I just think, and there's other kinds of name calling. Sometimes it's not, you know, complete demonization, but you know, certainly there's name calling in, well, he's not a very good Catholic. I mean, there's a website right now where you can go online and ask the bishop of any Catholic politician in the country to refuse to give him communion or her communion if they were to show up at Mass. The idea that because somebody doesn't agree necessarily with the way we see everything makes them a bad Catholic and therefore that's reason not to vote for them, or it's a reason to embarrass them publicly by calling them out and saying you can't go to communion. I don't think that kind of name-calling accomplishes very much. It certainly doesn't help an intelligent discussion of the issue, and it also presumes that the people who disagree with us are automatically bad Catholics, or automatically making immoral choices, or automatically immoral people. I'm not sure all that follows.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, the issue of Catholic politicians makes this issue particularly acute, because you have people who are voting publicly on these issues, whereas the average voter, you know, makes the decision in private, you know, after consulting his or her conscience. So it's kind of it's writ large for politicians in a way it is not for the average voter.
No, that's exactly right. But I still would say that those kinds of that kind of name calling doesn't advance the debate in any rational way. I mean, to say that I can't vote for you because you're a bad Catholic. Well, okay, in what ways are you a bad Catholic? Well, you're a bad Catholic because you failed to vote for a law. Well, let me give you a more concrete example. When Secretary Sebelius was the governor of Kansas, she had before her an abortion control bill, which she vetoed. And automatically she was called a bad Catholic. She shouldn't be Secretary of Health and Human Services because how can we have a bad Catholic hand out funds to Catholic hospitals and so forth, which are funded by HHS? But when you looked at her reasons for vetoing the bill, well, at least one of them was her belief that it was an unconstitutional restriction on that Ninth Amendment right. If that's the way she saw it, she didn't veto the bill because she's pro-abortion. She vetoed the bill in order to spare the state the unnecessary expense of legislation which they were going to be doomed to lose. I mean, you know, it's difficult to characterize the reasons why a politician does a certain thing, and to assume that they're always the bad reasons, I think is again one of the ways we've allowed demonization to enter our political discourse.
Now, we're a good 14, 15 months from the next election, yet we're publishing this article in the magazine. We're talking about these issues. Is it too early for, you know, Catholics to start thinking about these?
Well, the bishops are going to be talking about faithful citizenship in their November meeting.
So they think it's time to start talking about these.
They think it's time, right. They think it's time. So I think it's time for us to, for Catholics who are concerned about how their faith and how their vocation to be holy affects their participation in the political process, how that plays out in the upcoming election cycle is very timely.
Well, Nick Cafardi, we want to thank you for spending a few minutes to talk about these issues with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you for calling.